From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Today, as Pride Month comes to a close, we hear from two individuals who help break barriers for LGBTQ people. Cleve Jones is a longtime activist. His mentor was Harvey Milk, the first openly gay elected official in San Francisco, who was assassinated in 1978. Jones went on to co-found the San Francisco AIDS Foundation and conceived the AIDS Memorial Quilt. Also, Mary Jane Meeker wrote her first book of lesbian pulp fiction in 1952, and nobody thought it would sell, but it sold 1.5 million copies. She went on to write many other lesbian-themed books, mostly under pen names. And Justin Chang reviews Irresistible, the new film written and directed by Jon Stewart. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today, as Pride Month comes to a close, our first guest is longtime LGBTQ activist Cleve Jones. He thinks of himself as part of the last generation of homosexuals who grew up not knowing if there was anyone else on the entire planet who felt the way he did. He moved to San Francisco in his early 20s and became active in the gay rights movement. One of his mentors was Harvey Milk, the first openly gay elected official in California, who was assassinated in 1978. When the AIDS epidemic started, Jones was working with the State Assembly's Speaker on gay rights issues and health issues. He went on to co-found the San Francisco AIDS Foundation and conceived the AIDS Memorial Quilt. He's had HIV for many years, and few of his old friends survived the epidemic. In 2016, Cleve Jones wrote a memoir called When We Rise, My Life in the Movement. He called it his attempt to describe not only his life, but what his generation fought for, what they lost, and what they won. He spoke with Terry Gross when his memoir was first published.
Cleve Jones, welcome to Fresh Air. Remind us of what the penalties were for having a consensual sexual relationship with somebody of the same gender when you were a teenager, knowing that you were gay. And we're talking about the 1960s.
The penalties for homosexual conduct would vary from state to state, but it was a felony in most states, punishable with prison terms of varying lengths.
So when you knew that you were gay, were you afraid that someday you would be arrested?
Yes, when I began to understand what the words meant that were being tossed my way, I went to my father's library. He was a psychologist, and looked it up. And, you know, it was pretty horrifying for a 13, 14-year-old kid to learn suddenly that his feelings are not only deemed criminal, but, you know, psychologically an illness. So that was the reality for my generation, growing up in a world that in which we were criminalized and considered to be ill.
And were a lot of people imprisoned for gay relationships back then?
You know, even in my town, even in San Francisco, thousands of gay men were arrested, usually using entrapment techniques, every single year for sexual behavior between consenting adults. That continued well into the 1970s until it was finally decriminalized in 1976, I believe.
So you were afraid to tell your parents that you were gay, in part because your father's a psychologist. You were afraid that he'd sign you up against your will for aversion therapy or electroshock therapy. How seriously did you worry about that?
Well, I was very concerned about it, and I delayed telling my parents until I was 18 so that they would no longer have the legal right to have me committed and be subjected to these procedures that are really pretty barbaric. And, you know, I think those fears were well-founded because for the first couple of years after I came out, there was very little contact with him, and he really wanted me to be cured, and I kept saying there's nothing to cure. Later, we were able to reconcile somewhat. But my fears were certainly grounded in reality.
And you write that you were hoarding pills. It sounds like you had a suicide plan just in case. What was the just in case?
Yeah, I felt that my life was over before it even really began, because it just seemed then that there was no way to have a decent life and to be gay. So I was terrified that I was going to be caught, and I'd already experienced quite a bit of bullying, and, you know, I just thought that only misery lay ahead, and that when I got caught, that would be the solution. And I wish I could say that was a thing of the past, but, you know, it's not. And even today, every year, we lose an awful lot of young people, teenagers, who take their own lives because they are gay or transgender.
So you found out that there was like a gay movement through being a Quaker. You and your mother went to Quaker meetings. She went to Quaker meetings because she wanted to be a Quaker so you'd have a reason to avoid the draft. This was during the Vietnam War. So how did going to Quaker meetings lead to your discovery of the gay rights movement?
The Quakers were very welcoming, and even back then, I think they were performing commitment ceremonies for same-sex couples. But really, the big news for me came not at Quaker meeting, but through Life magazine. And it was the Year in Review issue of 1971. And they had a big spread called Homosexuals in Revolt. And I think it was 8 or 9 pages of text and photographs. And it was just the most astonishing thing for me. Stonewall, the rebellion in New York's Greenwich Village, had happened just 2 years prior. But if you were a teenage kid in Phoenix, Arizona, you didn't know about that. So this magazine, in a matter of minutes, revealed to me that there were other people like me, there were a lot of us, that we were organizing, that there was a community, and there were places where we could live safely, and that one of those places was called San Francisco.
So you met Harvey Milk. He became a mentor to you. Yeah. How would you describe his importance in the gay rights movement?
Well, he's often described as the first openly gay person to be elected to public office. That's inaccurate, and in my book, I make sure to credit the half dozen or so individuals who came before him in various places in the country. But I think that Harvey's significance really was that he became our first shared martyr. The word of his assassination spread far and wide. And even though gay people had lost many people to violence, to suicide, to drugs and alcohol, here was this symbolic figure that just struck a chord with people. For those of us in San Francisco, it was fascinating to see this guy who was really just kind of, you know, like one of your local neighborhood characters assume this worldwide significance.
So in 1977, Anita Bryant led a campaign to overturn a gay rights ordinance in Dade County, Florida. And after winning, she vowed to take that campaign nationwide. So after her group kind of won in 1977, there was a big protest in San Francisco. And, you know, Harvey Milk helped channel, you see, he helped channel the anger into a march. So describe him in action during that protest.
Harvey was very smart and really good at working with crowds of people, and he did not want violence. So when people were angry, when people were frightened, he would bring us all together so we could have that sense of power that comes from being together in the street and taking over the street. And then he would march us, and we created this march route that went for miles and miles up and down some of the steepest hills in San Francisco. And the main reason we did this was, first, of course, to show our anger and our determination, but also to make sure that by the end of it, everybody would be too tired to break windows or fight the police.
Really? That was part of the strategy?
It was march them till they drop. That was the strategy. And there were so many times when we would go roaring through town at, you know, 11 o'clock at night, tens of thousands of people screaming bloody murder, but without breaking a single window or injuring a single person.
Yeah, you say that Harvey Milk's attitude was don't burn down your neighborhood.
Yeah.
So in 1978, California State Senator John Briggs proposed a bill, which became known as the Briggs Initiative, or Proposition 6, that would ban gay people from working in any capacity in California public schools. What was your role in opposing that?
At that time, there were only a few local jurisdictions in the entire country that had passed any kind of legal protections for the people we now call LGBT. And the movement to repeal them was gaining speed. We had the loss in Dade County, also defeats in Wichita and St. Paul and Eugene. So initially, we looked at Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative, as an inevitable defeat and a really grave threat, because this was a bill that would ban anyone who was LGBT or anyone who supported them from working in any capacity in any public school in the entire state. So it was a real attack against gay people, against workers, against teachers. And Harvey thought it was very important that the young people who were joining gay liberation in droves be organized in an effective way. So my first responsibility in that campaign was to head out and visit all of the campuses and pull together the usually very small gay student organizations that existed at that time and build a coalition. So that was how it began.
And what was the outcome?
Well, contrary to all the predictions, we won that election. And, you know, it would be decades before we won another statewide election like that. And the history has largely been forgotten. And back then, even that early on in the movement, we were able to win. And I think that we did it by coming out. And that was Harvey's main message to the community, was that we had to come out. We had to take the risks. And yes, there were risks. There were potential repercussions that could be very serious. He never diminished that. But he said that everyone had a responsibility to themselves, to their families, to their community, and to the movement to come out of the closet. So in that campaign against the Briggs Initiative, you saw literally tens of thousands of ordinary people knocking on doors and saying, please, I'm your neighbor. I live down the street. I'm gay. If this passes, it will hurt me. It will harm my family. I think that's how we won.
You did that kind of work too, didn't you? Knock on doors?
Yes, I did.
Activist Cleve Jones speaking to Terry Gross in 2016. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with activist Cleve Jones. They spoke in 2016 when his memoir, When We Rise, My Life in the Movement, was first published.
You were working for Harvey Milk when he was assassinated by Dan White, and you knew, you saw police, you knew something was wrong when you came to the office. You had a kind of personal way of getting in there so that the police weren't blocking your way, and you came upon Harvey Milk's dead body and saw a police officer picking up the body, and you saw an explicitly horrible death. What lasting impact did that have on you? You can't unsee something like that. You can't erase it from your mind.
Well, you know, it changed my life forever. And you know, when I came around the corner and saw him, I saw his feet sticking out in the hallway. Dan White had invited him into his office and shot him there, and his feet were sticking out in the hall, and I recognized his wingtip shoes. He had secondhand shoes that he bought at a thrift store. And then we couldn't leave. We were stuck there because the police were doing their thing, and we played the tape that he'd left for us to play because he predicted his assassination. And I used to tease him for it and tell him he wasn't important enough to get shot. So that was pretty eerie and very horrible to be sitting in his office, listening to his voice, predicting his death while his body's there in the hallway. I knew by the end of the day that that was the single most important moment of my life. And it was the single most important thing that had happened to me, meeting Harvey, seeing his death. It fixed my course.
You got a job after Harvey Milk's assassination with the State Assembly's Speaker, the State Assembly of California, to work on gay rights and to monitor the Assembly's Health Committee and serve as the liaison between the committee's Democratic members and the Speaker, who was Leo McCarthy. And that's how you first found out about AIDS before that word was known. You had to, as part of your job, read the CDC's weekly morbidity and mortality report. And back in 1981, you read about something called pneumocystis pneumonia. Did you realize right away that this was something that was going to decimate a lot of the gay community? Like, what was the first article about it that you read? What were the clues?
It was the first week of June 1981, and I read in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report about these cases of pneumocystis pneumonia and Kaposi's sarcoma among young, previously healthy homosexual men. And I remember being very puzzled by it and alarmed. I cut it out and put it on the bulletin board at my office. About a month later, the New York Times did their first story about it, and I cut that out too. And about the same time, I got a call from Dr. Marcus Conant, who was a dermatologist at the University of California, San Francisco. And he wanted to talk with me because he knew that I worked for the Democratic leadership, and he was already, you know, predicting that we were going to need to raise and spend significant sums of money for research and treatment. So he took me to dinner at a place called the Zuni Cafe. It's still there on Market Street. And told me that he thought it was a new virus, sexually transmitted, maybe dormant for many, many years, that it attacked the immune system in some way that he couldn't understand and was fatal. And there was something about the way he delivered this information that just went right to my heart. And I knew that night. And I, you know, I looked up at him and I said, well, then we're all dead. And he said, you know, maybe. He then took me to meet a young man who was dying at the UCSF hospital. His name was Simon. And, you know, he was in an isolation ward. And it was pretty horrifying to see close up what the disease did to him. That was June of 1981. By the fall of 1985, almost everyone I knew was dead or dying or caring for someone who was dying.
When were you diagnosed?
I tested positive for HIV the week the test came out, which I'm thinking was 1985. It's at that time is a bit of a blur, but yeah, I tested positive, and I had been in a study I had volunteered for, so that I knew that they had samples of my blood going back all the way to 1977. So I learned that not only did I have HIV, but I learned that I'd had it since the winter of 78, 79. So I never expected to survive.
And you almost didn't.
I didn't get seriously ill until 1993. And then I got very sick. My immune system collapsed. And I was also allergic to many of the drugs used to treat the opportunistic infections, particularly pneumocystis pneumonia. So I moved out into the woods. I got a little cabin out in the Redwood Forest north of San Francisco and thought that would be as good a place as any to finish up. And Dr. Conant got me in one of these first studies for what we now call the cocktail. And it was a combination of three drugs, and I responded almost immediately. So that was November of 94 that I started on treatment, and it came just in time to save my life.
You say the movement saved your life because you think it was in part because of ACT UP that the trials of these drugs were sped up?
Well, I mean, that's really what this book is about. The movement saved my life twice. I was planning to kill myself when I was 15 because I thought I was the only queer in the world, and I didn't want to live that way, and I didn't want to be ashamed and beaten up. And then I read about gay liberation in Life magazine, and I decided not to kill myself, and I flushed flushed the pills down the toilet. And then when I was dying of AIDS and could barely walk, of course it was ACT UP that saved my life. It was all of the activism and all the people who participated in that struggle to change the way the drugs were tested, to change the double-blind placebo policies, to make access of, you know, for people that were dying, and it absolutely saved my life. None of that would have happened if it hadn't been for ACT UP and people like Larry Kramer driving people nuts with their anger and rage. But nonetheless, you know, it was very well focused and it had extraordinary results. And anybody who was part of that struggle during that time would say, yes, absolutely, Cleve, you're alive because of activism.
How's your health now?
It's good. And, you know, when that fall, when the meds started to work, I ran into a friend at the grocery store. It was one of my first trips out by myself, able to walk, go shopping, you know, live a semi-normal life. And we're in the produce section, and I see my friend, and he's been in the same study, and he's responding well to the meds. And he said, well, I guess we're not going to die. And I said, no, I guess we're not going to die. And then one of us or the other said, but we'll never be happy again. And I thought, no, that's true. We'll never be happy again. And, you know, I'm 62, I'm healthy, I'm happy, and very grateful to be alive today.
Was it hard to learn how to be happy when you'd lost so many of your friends to the epidemic?
I'm still learning. I think anyone who goes through that kind of experience with that kind of the enormity of the loss, you know, it's similar, I think, to being in a war. And I think of my friends every day. There are some days when it is so painful, I really can barely function. But I have to, and I do, and I find that I get my strength from my community and my friends, and I am surrounded by people who went through that time with me, and we support each other, and we love each other, and are grateful for every bit of laughter and joy that comes our way.
Cleve Jones, thank you so much for talking with us, and I wish you all best and good health.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Cleve Jones speaking to Terry Gross in 2016. His memoir is titled When We Rise, My Life in the Movement. He's now an organizer with Unite Here, a labor union for hospitality workers. Panels of the AIDS Memorial Quilt will soon be on display through a partnership with Vivint Health. I'm David B. Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from DuckDuckGo, a privacy company committed to raising the standard of trust online. Used by millions, they work to help people search privately and avoid trackers. DuckDuckGo, privacy simplified. And from Progressive Insurance, comparing car insurance rates from multiple insurers so shoppers can evaluate options in one place. Now that's Progressive. Comparisons available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David B. Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Mary Jane Meeker, holds an important place in the history of paperback books and lesbian literature. Her 1952 novel, Spring Fire, was one of the first paperback originals to deal with a lesbian theme. It sold about 1.5 million copies. Its success led to the publication of many more lesbian-themed paperbacks, including more by Meeker. She wrote her early lesbian novels under the pen name Vin Packer. And under her own name, Mary Jane Meeker wrote a memoir about her 2-year affair in the 1950s with Patricia Highsmith, best known as the author of Strangers on a Train, which was adapted into an Alfred Hitchcock film, and The Talented Mr. Ripley. Mary Jane Meeker is 93 years old. Her most recently published book, Scot Free, came out in 2011 and was a crime novel centered around a transgendered librarian. Terry Gross spoke with Mary Jane Meeker in 2003 when her memoir, Highsmith, A Romance of the 1950s, was first published. It explores not only her relationship with Highsmith, but also lesbian culture of the 1950s. They began with a reading from the opening of the book.
Els was on a little side street in Greenwich Village, a dark, cozy lesbian bar. It was the beginning of graciousness in the lesbian bar world. There was no evidence of mafia ownership, no men in baggy, double-breasted suits sporting pinky rings guarding the door. In fact, no men were allowed. The bathroom was clean. The customers didn't seem to be divided so much into butch and femme. Most looked like young college girls, well-dressed, and without the heavy makeup some habitués wore. Hookers were often regular customers of gay bars. Their butches waited for them there. But there was none of that in Els. The women behind the bar and at the door were welcoming. The music was mellow. Jerry Southern singing You Better Go Now, and Frances Faye crooning I'm Drunk with Love. A handsome, dark-haired woman in a trench coat, drinking gin, stood at the bar, while around her there was the buzz that she was Claire Morgan. She was better known in the outside world as Patricia Highsmith, author of Strangers on a Train. But in Els, Pat was revered for her pseudonymous novel, The Price of Salt, which had been published in 1952. It was for many years the only lesbian novel in either hard or soft cover with a happy ending. It stood on every lesbian bookshelf, along with classics like The Well of Loneliness, We Two Are Drifting, Diana, and Olivia.
Mary Jane Meeker, what did Patricia Highsmith mean to you before you actually met her at this bar?
Well, in the 50s, in the early 50s, we used to play a game of truth. And I remember one night, the question was, if you could be anyone besides yourself, a living person, who would you choose to be? And I actually said Patricia Highsmith. I loved her writing. I think we shared a common theme, which was folie à deux, sort of simultaneous insanity, two people involved with each other very closely, often in a crime. I think that was and her writing, of course, was what drew me to her before I even knew her.
You were both popular writers. Who was more out at the time? And were you out in different ways?
I was far more out. I was politically active, and I was interested in the new movement for gay rights and in New York. She was not at all interested in anything like that. She wasn't interested in politics. She really wasn't very interested in any kind of gay identity. So I was, and we had a little, we always disagreed on that point. She would say, we're just, what we do in bed is nobody's business. And I would try to remind her that we were more than horizontal people and that we did have a bit of entitlement. But that didn't interest Pat.
Let's talk more about your life. First of all, when you realized that it was girls, not boys, that you were attracted to, had you ever heard the word lesbian or heard that there was such a thing?
Oh, yes. I went to boarding school deliberately because I wanted to find out about this world that I knew I was part of. And I had read that boarding schools were filled with perversion. So I was very eager to go to boarding school, and I was rewarded, indeed, boarding school. But no, I read everything I could find. The minute I knew things were wrong with me, I read everything that I could find. Then after boarding school, when I chose college, I chose deliberately a co-ed college because I thought maybe I should cure myself. The one thing I didn't know in all my readings and studyings about lesbianism was that there isn't a cure. And in those days, it was considered an illness, and you were led to believe it could be cured.
Now, you were among the first lesbian pulp novelists. You wrote for Gold Medal, which is famous, among other things, for first publishing original paperbacks. In other words, these were books that were never in hardcover. And most
That's
of these
right.
were pulp novels. They were, you know, crime novels and sex-oriented novels.
Mm-hmm.
How did you end up writing lesbian pulp fiction for Gold Medal?
Well, first of all, pulp isn't really, I know everybody calls it pulp. I call it paperback. Pulp, to me, were the pulp, wonderful pulp magazines that paid a penny a word.
Sure, yeah.
And that was pulp.
Right.
But now it's become pulp. You must remember that these paperback writers were very well paid, far better paid than you would be in hardcover. And so you had writers like John McDonald, Day Keen, Charles Williams. They were wonderful writers. They wrote everything from westerns to mysteries. And there was nothing racy, really, about the gold medal line, except they did start writing lesbian novels, thanks to the book I wrote called Spring Fire.
How did you write Spring Fire, your first lesbian paperback?
I became friendly with the editor, Dick Carroll, and he said, if you had a story to write, what would you write about? And I said, well, I just came from college, and before that I was in boarding school, and I had a lesbian experience in boarding school, and I think I would write about that. And he said, oh, that's a wonderful idea, but make it college, because he said, grade school people don't read our books. Make it college. And so then I wrote Spring Fire. He called it Spring Fire because James Michener had a novel out called The Fires of Spring. And Dick thought, maybe people will confuse this with Michener and we'll have double the sales. Because nobody really thought a book about lesbians was going to sell anything.
You sold 1.5 million copies, if what I read
yes.
is
many,
correct.
Many, yes. It went into many, many reprints.
Mary Jane Meeker speaking to Terry Gross in 2003. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from DuckDuckGo, a privacy company committed to making privacy online simple. Used by millions, they offer private search and tracker blocking with one download. DuckDuckGo, privacy simplified. And from Morgan Stanley, a proud sponsor of StoryCorps. Morgan Stanley is committed to giving back and to fostering meaningful dialogue among people and communities. MorganStanley.com.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2003 interview with author Mary Jane Meeker. She wrote dozens of books under her own name and several pseudonyms, including many with lesbian themes and protagonists.
Now, one of the things your editor told you at Gold Medal was that you had to have a happy ending to this lesbian novel. Why did you need that?
Yes, because these paperbacks went through the mail, and the mail censored things. And if there was anything that seemed to proselytize for a vice like lesbianism, why, then they would junk the whole shipment. Everybody's books would go down with yours because they couldn't bother to unpack and find your books. So we had to have happy endings if we were writing about, quote, perversion, unquote. And so that was what I did with Spring Fire. And the unhappy endings were hilarious. I mean, I look at them. I can't believe I wrote them.
But, well, in fact, you brought one of your novels with
yes,
you. The first one, Spring
one.
Fire.
Mm-hmm.
Can you and read the happy ending for us?
Here's the happy ending. She's just left her psychoanalyst or psychiatrist's office, Susan. And she is, and he is saying, Dr. Peters lingered in the hall near the door as Susan Mitchell buttoned her coat and put her scarf around her head. Then I'll see you on Tuesday, he said, taking her hand in a friendly goodbye. And have a nice weekend, Susan. Any big plans? I'm going on a hayride tonight. Robin and Tom and Lucifer and me. That's about all I planned. He let her hand go and smiled as he held the door open. It sounds like fun, he answered. Bye, Susan. It was cold, and there was a warning of snow in the fresh sweep of the breeze. As Mitch is Susan, as Mitch walked along the path from the hospital, she had a clean feeling that was there whenever she finished talking with Dr. Peters, and she knew she was whole now. The tower bell struck five times, and distant figures of students carrying books, hurried along the fire walks, their breaths frosting faintly in the cold air. When she went by the auditorium, she could hear the university choir rehearsing for the Christmas pageant, and the nostalgic strains drifted out to her. Dusk was dressing the campus, and as Mitch walked with the music in her heart, she thought of Lita, hazily, as though she were someone she had known a long, long time ago. She knew that if it had been any other way, if Lita Taylor could have been helped and could have at that moment walked there too and known the peace in the twilight and the first hints of frost on the grass and the bushes surrounding Cranston, Mitch would have wanted that, because it was true what she had told Lita yesterday. She didn't hate her. She didn't hate her at all, and she knew then that she had never really loved her.
So she has a kind of like heterosexual awakening at the end?
Oh, she goes to a doctor, and he turns her into a heterosexual. That's why she says she's going off with these wonderful straight couples for fun that weekend. Yes, and she realizes not only is she a heterosexual, but she never really was a homosexual.
Right, so this made it safe to travel through the mails. How did you feel when you were writing this phony ending?
I laughed. I was not politically conscious to that point. It really hadn't begun yet. I wrote this, I think it was 51 or 52. I was right out of college, and I thought it was a funny idea. You don't have any, when you're writing these things, you don't have any vision of the future, of their even being there or discussed in the future. It was, I was delighted to get my first book published, and if that was the rule, well, I was willing to follow it.
Okay, now we're talking about the kind of happy ending you had to paste onto your novel so that it wouldn't be censored in the mail. A subsequent novel that you wrote, also a lesbian novel, called Whisper His Sin. I'm sorry,
I guess
this is a homosexual novel.
Yes, that was actually based on a true murder case, the Fraiden-Wetman murder case. Two young men murdered one of their mothers. And I just copied that. I created that book from the news stories. I made it fiction. These titles were never my titles either.
Whisper His Sin.
Yes.
But the cover copy was, "This is one of the most shocking novels we have ever published. It deals with a strange way of life that has become all too prevalent and is still spreading. The book begins in the tormented mind of a boy and ends in the tormented murder of his parents. Between this beginning and this end, there is a frightening picture of how the blight of sexual distortion spreads, corrupts, and finally destroys those around it. We also believe that this is one of the most morally enlightening books you will ever read." Was it important in terms of censorship to put all this morally enlightening stuff on the cover?
Yes, that was all part of it. I think gay people felt, because we didn't have a sense of entitlement in the 50s, but we felt there are books about us. Even a book about a criminal case like Fraiden and Wetman, we were suddenly there. We hadn't been there before all of this. We didn't exist. And even if there were a few books about us, they were never reviewed. They were never put out in the bookstore or the window. You had to somehow find about them in an underground way. So as we became more open, yes, we had these cautionary blurbs that our publishers wrote, but still it was more important to have us there.
Now, the books that we talked about, Whisper His Sin and
yes.
Spring Fire, were both written under the pen name Vin Packer. Your name
yes.
is Mary Jane Meeker. Why
right.
didn't you use your own name?
Well, I have always had a reluctance to using my own name. Even now, I still don't write under my own name, unless it's something like the Highsmith book, where I would have to. I like pseudonyms. I like disguises. I've always hated the name Mary Jane, and I think the idea that you can name yourself is interesting. That Vin Packer, unfortunately, wasn't a very well-thought-out name. We were having lunch with I was having lunch with a man named Vincent and a woman whose name was Annie Packer. So I put Vin Packer together, never thinking that there would be any life to this name. But there was a considerable life. I did 22 books under that name.
What didn't work about the name?
Well, I just thought it was a silly name. It sounded like a sportscaster. And I don't know. I might have thought more carefully about it if I had thought I was going to be with it that long. Mm-hmm. But I was my own agent. That was another name for the pseudonyms. I had I couldn't get an agent, so I printed stationery up and became an agent. And all of my pseudonyms were me. All of my clients were me. And I would take people out to lunch and tell them about my clients. And nobody knew that I was all my clients.
What was your name as an agent?
Mary Jane Meeker.
Oh, I see. So a lot of people really thought that Mary Jane Meeker was an agent.
Oh, yes.
Wow.
Oh, yes. even my editor, Dick Carroll, thought so in the beginning.
You write really well about gay bars in your new memoir about Patricia Highsmith. And you write how a lot of the gay bars were run by the mafia in the 1950s.
Yes.
What were those bars like?
They were terrible. You would go in, and at the door there would be a man in a low man on the totem pole in the mafia world. He would usually have a couple of zircons on his little fingers and a double-breasted suit, and he would smoke cigars, and he would watch the door, mainly watch to keep men out. And these bars were terrible bars. There was a woman that sat outside the ladies' room and gave you one piece of toilet tissue at a time, and you went in single file because they imagined that you would go in there with other women and do terrible things in the ladies' room. And, of course, there were no men in, so there was no man's room. But the ladies' room was always terrible shape. There was always a plunger on the floor somewhere needed at some point. They just didn't keep them clean. And they took advantage of the fact that you were lucky to have any place to go.
What are some of the things that happened after Stonewall and after the start of the gay rights movement that have affected your life that you thought you would never see?
Mm-hmm. The main thing I thought I would never see, and if my parents weren't dead, it would kill them, is the announcements in the New York Times, the commitment announcements, mm-hmm. along with the wedding pages. That, to me, is miraculous and wonderful. And I think, to me, it's the thing that gives me the most pleasure. That's one thing. And, of course, so many changes, the freedom among the young people to announce that they're gay. The idea that it's not unusual today for a parent to hear from a child, "I'm gay," and to handle it. And you don't seem to hear anymore about going to an analyst to be cured. It doesn't exist anymore. And even the Psychoanalytic Society has finally taken us off the abnormal list. I see progress everywhere, and it's thrilling to me.
Well, Mary Jane Meeker, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Author Mary Jane Meeker speaking to Terry Gross in 2003. After a break, film critic Justin Chang reviews Irresistible, the new film comedy written and directed by Jon Stewart and starring Steve Carell. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Jon Stewart, former longtime host of The Daily Show, has written and directed a new political comedy film called Irresistible, which begins streaming today on video on demand platforms. It stars Steve Carell as a Democratic Party strategist who gets involved in a political race in a small Wisconsin town. Our film critic, Justin Chang, has this review.
Jon Stewart hasn't exactly been quiet in the years since his departure from The Daily Show. He's been a forceful advocate for 9/11 first responders, and he's appeared occasionally on his friend Stephen Colbert's show to offer withering views on President Trump. But there's little of that focus and passion in his disappointing and misleadingly titled new movie, Irresistible. It's a political satire that wants to say something timely and significant, but feels exasperatingly out of step with the present moment. The movie stars Steve Carell as Gary Zimmer, a longtime Democratic strategist who is reeling from Hillary Clinton's 2016 electoral defeat when the movie opens. A few months after Trump's inauguration, Gary is ready to jump back into the fray. He believes the party's future rests on the unlikely shoulders of Colonel Jack Hastings, a Marine veteran and dairy farmer from a small, economically blighted Wisconsin town called Deerlocken. Jack, played by a very good Chris Cooper, has just given a passionate speech defending the town's undocumented workers in a video that has gone viral. He may not look or sound like a traditional Democrat, but that's why Gary thinks he's the perfect guy to rebrand the party's image and show that Republicans don't have a monopoly on family values, military heroism, and love of country. You can see why Gary would gravitate toward a white, rural everyman in the immediate wake of 2016. But a lot has changed since then. And right now, when the next generation of elected Democrats includes leaders like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, it feels like an awfully dated premise. In any event, Gary hops on a private jet to Deerlocken, where he persuades Jack to run for mayor as a Democrat against the Republican incumbent. Some fish-out-of-water comedy ensues. Carell is good at playing self-important characters with minimal self-awareness, and Gary's jittery East Coast energy is amusingly at odds with this mostly conservative town. But his plan starts to work. The Republican Party gets wind of what's happening and starts funding the mayor's re-election campaign. Camera crews, polling experts, and super PACs descend on Deerlocken. So does a rival GOP strategist, Faith Brewster, clearly modeled on Kellyanne Conway and played by a typically on-point Rose Byrne. Here, Gary and Faith get in a heated argument during a CNN-style interview.
The Democrat Party can't win. They're getting desperate. They don't know us. They don't want to know us. And they look down on our bodies.
No, that's we. You're D.C. elite.
Oh, no, actually, I'm from here.
Faith, I didn't know that. You're from Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, no, Deerlocken. I'm from Deerlocken.
What? Oh. Whoa.
Wow, so this campaign has been a bit of a homecoming.
It really is, Brooke. Thank you.
No. That's a lie. That's a lie.
No, it's...
You're lying. What are you even doing?
Well, as always, a great and spirited discussion.
Stewart is drawing partly on reality. The character of Jack was inspired by John Ossoff, the upstart Georgia Democrat who nearly flipped a conservative House district in a special election in 2017 and is now running for the Senate. But the director is also channeling the whimsical spirit of classic Frank Capra films like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, with its corny but stirring celebration of small-town idealism. Irresistible wants to be a Capra-esque fable, but it also wants to offer a cynical insider's view of everything that's wrong with American politics. The two modes don't really gel, and so the movie weirdly comes off as both naive and smug. It's easy enough to grasp Stewart's main argument. He's using the absurdity of the Deerlocken situation to call out the corrupting influence of money in politics, the way funds get poured into campaigns rather than solutions. He's also ribbing the media for stoking divisions and pushing both sides toward greater extremes. We live in a broken system, Stewart is saying, where the right and the left are equally culpable. Whether or not you agree with that assumption, Stewart is trying to present both sides. In movie terms, that means treating the people of Deerlocken with kid gloves, while subjecting Gary, the clueless liberal, to relentless critical scrutiny. Mackenzie Davis gives a nice performance as Jack's daughter, who consistently puts Gary in his place. It's too bad that Irresistible is nearly as out of touch as Gary is. The movie's dreamy, fable-like qualities leave it feeling utterly divorced from present-day reality. Of course, it's not Stewart's fault that he shot this film well before this year's extraordinary mass protests against racism. Even still, the lack of any significant characters of color, or of any mention of race beyond a few lame jokes about Black and Latino voters, feels pretty glaring for a political movie released in 2020. I liked Stewart's 2014 drama Rosewater, but cinematic satire seems to elude him. He could spin nightly headlines into sharp commentary, but he can't give this toothless movie the bite that it needs.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. On Monday's show, Lin-Manuel Miranda returns to Fresh Air. He created the musical Hamilton and starred as Alexander Hamilton in the original Broadway production. A filmed version of that production will start streaming on Disney Plus July 3rd. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Charlie Kyer, Joyce Lieberman, and Julian Hertzfeld. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inclui.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, offering its HomeQuote Explorer so shoppers can evaluate options in one place when buying home insurance. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com. And from Quicken Loans, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans is committed to their clients, team members, and communities. Resources for people experiencing financial hardship are available online at rocketmortgage.com.